Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd. And there's nothing wrong with your hearing. My voice does sound a little hoarse, and we'll get to that later. But first, if you're like most people, you've surely asked yourself, how can I make my dreams come true? How can I spend July in Baltimore? Well, search no longer. The 10th annual Baltimore Improv Festival runs from July 25th through the 31st. It's sponsored by the Baltimore Improv Group. Come play in front of some of the largest, loudest, most supportive audiences you'll find at any festival in America. For more information, to register, go to BaltimoreImprovFestival.org. That's BaltimoreImprovFestival.org. Also, submissions are now open for the Out of Bounds Comedy Festival in Austin, Texas. Out of Bounds is Austin's longest-running independent comedy festival in its 15th year, featuring the best in stand-up, sketch, improv, and theatrical comedy from across the globe. Out of Bounds is accepting submissions for a variety of acts until 11:59 p.m. Central Standard Time on April 30th. So, visit www.outofboundscomedy.com for more details. That's www.outofboundscomedy.com. And don't forget to register for my award-winning Artist Low Comedy Weekend Intensive here in Chicago. They'll be offered the weekend of July 30th and the 31st and August 6th through the 7th. Spaces are filling up, so register now. Go to jimmycarain.com. That's jimmycarain.com. We have got another great episode of Improv Nerd for you, and this episode was recorded in beautiful, sunny Los Angeles, California. It is the first of five episodes that we recorded when we were out there. Our guest today is John Lehrer and Nancy Hauer. They create and produce sitcoms that are improvised, such as 10 Items or Less for TBS and Quick Draw for Hulu. John improvised with the group Ed after graduating from Northwestern here in Chicago in the late 90s. Nancy studied at Juilliard and fronted two rock bands and actually opened for Meatloaf. We talked to them about why they use improv in their shows, how they solve creative differences between the two of them, and opening for Meatloaf. Before we get to the episode, just a note about my voice, my scratchy, hoarse voice. It is not a cold. I am not sick. I am sick, but it's a different kind of sickness. As you know, I've discussed this on this podcast before. My father died about a month ago. This weekend will be his funeral. His memorial mass. And I got an email on Wednesday from my sister saying that just my older brother Bobby and my sister Molly will be speaking at the funeral, but no one else. That really got me really angry. And hurt too, actually. And scared, all sorts of emotions. So I called my brother and told him that I would like to speak at, I will be speaking at the Mass. And he said, no, you're not. And then the next thing I know, I went into a full-out blackout rage where I used the F words, F-bombs all over the place and actually hung up on him. So I'm kind of feeling that effect. And then I went to group therapy that afternoon. And process it. We call it processing, just so you know. And then I did some screaming exercises. So my voice is shot. So I'm not going to talk anymore. I'm going to let this interview speak for me. Here it is, John Lehrer and Nancy Hauer, the John Lehrer and Nancy Hauer episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
John Lehrer and Nancy Hauer, thank you for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jimmy. Big fans.
Yeah. Thank you. That makes me, because you actually do listen to it.
I do.
You?
I'm a fan. Everyone you put out, I'm there.
So we're going to start with Nancy. You grew up in northern New Jersey.
I did. And
in a blended family with a total of nine kids from four previous marriages, right?
Well, gosh.
Three from the
three.
Current marriage, and then two lived with your dad and stepmom?
Yes.
Okay.
And then four lived... You didn't know this, John.
It's hard to track her family down. It's
four,
like...
Seven lived with me, and then two lived with my dad.
So how does that prepare you for comedy? A career in comedy.
I mean, you're constantly in a crowd. I was the youngest of the seven. So you had to really speak up to be heard. But, you know, I mean, the seven people is a lot. That's a lot of people. And generally, every one of them had like 10 friends. So at any one time in my house, it was always like, I would say no less than 15 people hanging out.
Was that hard to get privacy as a kid?
I used to go play in my closet a lot. And I'm not kidding.
What would you do in your closet when you play? Because it's a very small space.
Oh, God. You know, I'd have dolls or, you know.
Dolls? Wow.
Yeah. Do you think that's
weird? Don't know. Yeah. I mean, she is girly.
I would constantly be like, I really did think up stories all the time. I remember I wrote a book when I was like 8, and I thought it really explained what the world was all about. And then I threw it out one day, just like, no. That's
Were you a performer back then to get attention in such a big family?
No, I would say I was pretty quiet, actually. I'm pretty quiet now, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think she's not somebody who demands attention. She sort of commands attention.
Like, What's the difference?
Well, the difference is I'm somebody who demands attention. I need attention, and I try to fish for it. I think with Nancy, people just naturally her.
She lays attention. Back and lets it come to you. You are pouncing on it.
Yes.
Yes. Now, you grew up in Overland Park, Kansas City. How did you first get involved in improv?
Well, in high school, there was this thing called forensics, which is a speech competition, not the study of dead bodies. And it was a very big deal for some reason in my high school. And one of the events that you would see a lot at tournaments was this IDA, improvised duet acting, which you and a partner would enter, and you'd pick a topic, and then you'd have 30 minutes to make a 5 to 7 minute sketch out of it. And I loved it.
You love about that?
I love the idea of not knowing what you're doing, and I like the abyss of it all, the just falling into unknowingness, the sort of combination of terror and excitement. I like that.
And Nancy, you went on to study acting at the Juilliard.
Yeah, the Juilliard School, yes.
Yeah, in New York. And then you moved to L.A. and you get a part on Star Trek Voyager.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like to be part of that show? Because, you know, Star Trek fans are...
It was
crazy.
I think, you know, in the beginning I got it. I think it was going to be a one-off, and I cried.
Which means one episode.
Yeah. I thought, oh, my God, this is the greatest thing that ever happened. And then it became recurring. And I lived off of that for years. I mean,
When you say live off it, how much money in those days could you, $30,000, $50,000, $100,000?
God, I can't remember.
They still write her all the time.
I still get checks. I mean, you know, it was the thing about that show was that it was already in
syndication.
So you did it. You got maybe, I can't remember, maybe 10 grand to do the show. But then you immediately got 10 grand again and again and again. And it was syndicated everywhere. So it was like unlike any other show.
And did you ever have any contact with the Star Trek fans?
Oh, yeah. They asked me to go do a thing.
One of the conventions?
Yeah. And I remember that I thought, oh, I'm going to be on a panel or something. And they flew me to Ohio. And they were like, okay, we're going down the steps to the stage. And I said, so how many people are on the panel? And they're like, it's just you. And I was like... What do you mean? And how much time am I supposed to take? And they were like 45 minutes. And I was like, I don't watch the show. And the guy started laughing. And I was like, no, I'm serious. Like, what am I supposed to say? And literally I hear like, ladies and gentlemen, you know, 2,000 people roaring. And then I walk out and I'm like, hey, you know, I don't watch this show, but, you know.
And what did the fans do then?
They thought it was a joke. I mean, I watched it a little bit, but I wasn't like a, you know.
Were you not? Because that's one genre, science fiction, I am not into. Were you not into science fiction?
I loved science fiction. Mm-hmm. And I loved the earlier Star Trek, But for some odd, I think I was so terrible on the show.
Really?
Yeah. Oh God.
What made you so bad? In when you look back at it?
When I went to go do it, they would be like, Nancy, you've got you. Every time you say a line, it seems like you're making a joke, and I'd be like, I am literally saying, like, so I'd be like, you know, Captain, the antimeter is not working. We've got to blah blah blah, and then everyone would start laughing. And then Kate Mulgrew would be like, Nancy, you got to just be flat. So I'd be like, Captain, the altimeter. And then they'd all start laughing. So this went on for a while. And then finally, I took a piece of gum and I stuck it in the top of my mouth.
Which you learned at Juilliard?
Yeah. Which I don't know why I thought to do this. But then it would be like, Captain, the altimeter is not working. And they were like, perfect. That's it. So all of my acting was gum acting. For 4.5 years.
That's what Juilliard teaches.
Mm-hmm.
But Northwestern teaches something else because that's where you went. And then you got into improv in Chicago. And you were part of two legendary groups called Ed and the Chris Hogan Show.
Yes. Yeah. Ed produced the Chris Hogan Show, so they were kind of related.
And Ed was like, Ed was legendary.
For like 9 people, including you and me, it was legendary. I mean, it was more women than men in the cast,
which was a big deal because it was early 90s, right?
Yes, and it was very sexist that usually groups would have like the fat guy, the skinny guy, the black guy, the gay guy, and the woman. And she would play all the whores and secretaries,
right.
You know. So this was more 4 women, 3 men. And it was this evolving, what they call long form now. We didn't call it then. But it was essentially, I guess, taking what Del Close pioneered. Maybe to the next, I don't know. What do you think, Jimmy? It seemed like it kind of made a play.
Yeah, and you did it in a theater, which was really, for that time, was really, really revolutionary.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, there were no blender sounds. There were no waitresses putting cocktail napkins down in front of the audience.
I remember going to the last performance of Ed at the Remains Theater, which was like...
Such a great theater.
Great theater, like 200...
I was just telling Nancy about it. It's a Bed Bath & Beyond now.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, saddest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah. But Nancy, there's more parking.
You know, that was a great theater.
Yeah, and I remember the last night, it was like 200 seats, was it, or 300?
Yeah, I think it was even more than that. I think it was like 250 or something like that.
And Lisa Harrison, who produced it.
Yes.
Great job producing it.
Yes.
Packed the house. And I remember watching it just being blown away by it.
Yeah, it was a very short flash period. And I think it did great work.
Is that the woman who became your agent?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Lisa, is she still your agent?
No. I'm now at CAA with Nancy. And we decided having separate agents wasn't the best idea. It wasn't the best
like
business
plan.
It's
like playing phone tag all day.
And then what do you think made Ed in the Chris Hogan Show so special?
Well, the Chris Hogan Show was an entirely different thing. The Chris Hogan Show was just 2 people. It was Chris Hogan and me. Mm-hmm. It was the first 2-man, 1-man solo show.
Yeah.
And it was super fast and totally different from Ed, which was kind of patient, relationship-based. But I would say the thing that made both of those shows different was probably Jim Denon, who was the creator.
And what I heard was you're the one who got Jim Denon to start directing improv.
That's
true.
Can
you tell us that story?
Well, his girlfriend at the time said her boyfriend Jim was a pre-med. He dropped out. He's very bright. He's very depressed. He needed something to do. And I was in a horrible improv group called Random Sample.
At Northwestern.
No, this was doing bar gigs in Chicago.
Okay.
Terrible, horrible bar gigs.
What was
gigs.
So bad about it?
I remember doing one at Shuba's where people were just booing the entire town. I remember
boo in Chicago for improv.
No. And this guy was pointing a finger right at me saying, you suck. You! And made sure he got eye contact with me. Just terrible. I mean, it was called Random Sample. I mean, it was bad.
Who thought of that title?
Not me. I was the low guy.
That doesn't sound like a title you'd come up with.
No, I was the young gun.
What would you have called it?
I don't even know. Nothing. Let's go home. Let's get a beer.
Right.
Jim, I got him to come in and sit on a couple of those rehearsals.
And he has no experience.
No experience. Never taken a theater class ever. But this super bright, crazy guy. And we had a beer after, and he said, if I had my own improv group, I would do this and this and this and this. And he started talking about moving forward and backward in time, and I was like, what? And it was just like, I'd never heard it described that way. And I was like, dude, you're gonna direct a show, and I would very much like to be in it.
So did you put Ed together with him?
Yeah, I mean, I was an actor in it. Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it was Jim was the director.
Right.
Lisa produced it, and I was a cast member, but I was a different kind of cast member because I had sort of dragged Jim in. I'm like, you know, listen, I'm no dummy. If you want to, you know, be in a show, just get a director to cast you, you know. That's essentially what I do with Nancy now that I think about it.
And then, so you do the Chris Hogan show, mm-hmm. and you and Chris then move out to Los Angeles, right?
Yeah, a talent scout from Fox saw the show in Chicago, flew us out here, had us do a showcase, you know, classic Hollywood kind of thing. We kicked ass and signed a development deal with TriStar.
Was it good money back then, those kinds of
things? To me, it was. It was like $15,000
right.
for a year. And I was just like, holy shit. I had never seen that much money in one lump sum. And I put it all right up my nose. It was fantastic.
Really?
Yes. I was on drugs at the time. And, you know, and that's exactly where I put it. Yeah. It was great for that, you know, month.
But because I remember in Chicago, you had a reputation of being a partier.
Yes. Yeah.
You're laughing. Why?
Because yes, I would think that was yes.
So when did you stop? When did you get?
This Sunday it'll be 20
He's
years.
Drunk right now.
Yeah, but I am drunk. But I decided to go ahead and start drinking.
Right, right.
Yeah.
It's funny about this podcast brings up a lot of. Yeah. It really encourages relapse. You know.
I quit once. I could do it again.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, how hard could it be? Mm-hmm. 20 years ago, I was arrested with possession of narcotics
here
with intent
in Los Angeles.
To sell in Ventura County.
Okay.
Possession
so
of narcotics with
time?
Intent to sell. No.
Okay.
No intention of, you know, selling any of those drugs.
Okay.
They were wrong about that.
And was that your bottom?
I guess so.
Okay.
I mean, I am a bottom, as you well know,
Jenny. Yes. Known from Chicago.
Yeah. I mean, you and I, yes. plenty, many, many.
Many, many, yeah. I'm kind of hurt to know that you were coked up when we had sex.
Listen, I'm not the only person you've made love to that was coked up. Okay. Had to be coked up.
Oh, God.
I'm going to be honest
with
you.
Okay,
I guess that would, yes. If I had to, I hate that term bottom, but yes, that would probably, it was pretty bad. I was in jail. I was on acid. I was, you know.
When you were doing like Jesse and you had a reality TV show, were you still doing drugs then?
Let's see. No, I think I was newly sober because I met Nancy when I got, Nancy and I knew each other when I was partying, but we started working together after I got sober. Mm-hmm. So no, I think Jesse, I was sober, newly sober, like maybe 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Was that hard? I mean, being newly sober and then getting this like network sitcom?
No, because I didn't have to do a thing. I was a mute character. I just had to stand there and I got paid $16,000 a week. It was fantastic. It was the best thing ever to happen to me. Ugh, lovely. You don't have to do anything. I played video games all day. In my dressing room.
And you didn't get
room.
Bored or get jealous, like, oh, why can't I have a bigger part? Or why can't this character...
God, no.
This is kind of what we do now. How is that different?
You're right.
I mean, you just looked at that as a paycheck. Because if it was me, it'd be like, oh, here's my big break.
Listen, I was just so grateful. I paid off my credit card. I had a credit card balance that I'd been carrying for like 10 years.
How high was it?
I think it was above 10 grand,
okay.
which back then was a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a lot of money.
Right.
I mean, still a lot of money.
Right.
And I remember I paid it off on my first check.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
I wrote a check and paid it off, and I just laid back and went, oh. Now I carry so much debt, like I laugh at $10,000. My kids use $10,000 worth of toilet paper a month now, you know?
So you two meet here in Los Angeles doing a film called Memron.
Well,
all Nancy. That was okay. Nancy actually started all our partnership. It's all her.
So let's talk about how you guys first met and what kind of impressions you had of each other.
Well, he was dating. I was in a band called Wench.
Okay, so let's hold on to that. How did you get into music?
Oh,
Nancy's a Renaissance person.
She does everything.
I was living next door to Jack Black.
Okay,
Jack,
before he was Jack Black.
Well, he was always Jack Black, but yes.
Yes.
And he had this little band called Tenacious D, and Jack was, and I started to learn the guitar, and I think I learned like three chords, and Jack said, hey, why don't you open for us at, you know, at the Actors Gang next month? And I was like, great, I'll get some of my friends and we'll do a fun little thing. It's the Actors Gang. Who cares? And then I asked 10 different people, and like five of them said yes. None of them really played. Like, we had a drummer who had no drums, and she'd just be like, good, I know what I'm going to do here. Let's move on. And
but they were all women.
Yeah.
Okay. And gorgeous, all of them.
And I made up these, like, really ridiculous songs. You know, they were very comedic. And we get there on the day, and HBO is there. And I said, Jack, what's going on? He goes, oh, I forgot to tell you, HBO's filming this. And I said, oh, we can't go on. We can barely play. This is like a joke, right? So we turned it down, and then we became legendary because we were like the people who turned down HBO. But really, nobody would do it. I would have gone on.
Right.
And everybody else was like, no way.
I love that. You turned it down because you were afraid.
Yeah.
And it becomes legendary.
Yes. So then the bass player of our band had a party, and like 200 people showed up, and we did one song, and we suddenly had a manager, and, you know, and
I think I was at that party.
You might have been.
Yeah.
And the guy...
Sober or...
No.
Okay.
Using.
Okay.
There was a guy who was playing the guitar. We always had a different bass player. It was all women and one guy. And then one of us would sleep with the guy and then break up, and the guy would get kicked out. Or die. One of them died.
They were super hot. It was like the Tubes, but women, and they were just awesome.
It was really fun. And then we kind of did that for like a year and became crazily popular. Like, Tenacious D opened for us at the Key Club, which we sold out, you know. And but it all kind of went awry, essentially, within a year, because they offered us a deal. Meatloaf offered us a deal. And then they turned it down when they actually saw us play. And then he called and said, well, you can have it because you wrote the songs, but I'm going to put all new people behind. So I turned that down.
Why'd you turn that down?
Because they were all my friends. I was like, this would be wrong, you know. But then the band kind of imploded within like 6 months, because I think everybody realized this is going to happen again. Because I'd written all the songs. I was the lead singer. I was, you know what I mean? It's like, and Meatloaf said it. He's like, I wanted to bring you out on tour, but how are you going to come on tour with, you know, people who can't play? So...
But they're really good looking.
They're really good looking.
Right.
And
really
that was my point.
Like,
was
model good looking? Were they like model?
Oh,
my
yeah.
God. Okay. Yes. They were all
yes.
Her backup singers. I dated one of them, as Nancy said.
And that's how we met.
They were hot.
He met his wife at one of my gigs.
Yes.
That was their first hookup.
I mean, was it? I would imagine a lot of guys would come to these shows and then hang around and try to hit on.
Not just guys. There were a billion lesbian followers, and I can't remember why.
Well, your drummer was gay.
Oh, right. But we had a lot of, and that's a huge audience, mm-hmm. and they're very loyal, which was amazing.
But you were good. Nancy was great. I was a fan, mm-hmm. and Nancy was really great. She just commanded the space and had a great voice, and the songs were funny, but they were good.
But did you realize that the other people couldn't play?
No, because I don't know anything about music.
Okay.
I thought they were great.
Everybody could play it was like literally three chords. Uh-huh. I mean, we weren't terrible, but we weren't like, you know, like, so we canceled the thing, we blew apart, and then Meatloaf called me like 6 months later, and he said, hey, I heard your band broke up. I'm sorry. I feel like I'm responsible. Come open for me at Wembley Stadium in 2 weeks. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. And he's like, you got to do it. So I said, alone? He's like, yeah, my band will back you up. So I went, I flew out to Wembley. And are we going totally off topic?
No, this is great. This is a great story.
Okay, so I fly out to Wembley. I get on the bus. I see the first gig. It's for like 30,000 people in Birmingham. And he's like, you're going to play in a week. And he introduces me to his band members. And he goes, hey, guys, Nancy's going to open for us next week. And they're all thinking, like, who is this? And his daughter was a backup singer. So he's like, Pearl's going to sing backup. So the band is pissed because they have to back me up but not get paid and be behind a sheet, apparently, because he doesn't want anybody to see them. So they won't rehearse with me. Now I
because they have kind of attitude?
Like, well, they're like, who are you?
Right.
And we're not getting paid. We'll show up for the gig and screw you. So
how did you deal with that?
I called my therapist every day and was like, I can, and she'd be like, envision yourself at Wembley. And I'd be like, I envision myself and the sound guy and nobody else. And she's like, you're getting there. And then, finally the night before Wembley, I went out and partied with these guys. And like, I'm not kidding, like 2 a.m, one of them goes, hey, you're pretty cool, you know? And I was like, thanks, you motherfuckers. Do you need to believe that?
No, you don't.
And he was like, I was like, you guys, I'm playing at Wembley tomorrow, and I've only played for like 700 people tops, you know? And they were like, you don't think we can do it? And I was like, I don't think I can do it. So they basically said,
really
okay,
evolved people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they go, we got the tape. So we showed up at like 3 o'clock that day, and we played for like 2 hours. I rehearsed with them, and it was like the most incredible, like weirdly, I had no nerves. I was like, this is the most incredible thing ever. And we all went down into the tunnel to get ready. My family flew out. We're all ready. And somebody comes back and says, hey, you guys, Meat's got a sore throat, so he's not going on tonight. And I was like, oh, great, guys. This is the joke you play on the newbie. And they're like, no, he wants to talk to you, Nancy. And I'm like, okay. So I go back out.
What are you feeling at this point?
This is totally a joke. There's no way. So I go back out. I see him, and he's like, hey, I'm sorry. I can't. And he walks. It's like that Coke commercial with the guy walking through the VOM, you know. And he walks out. He gets into the limo and drives off. And I turn to one of the guys. I'm like, this is really going far for a joke. He's like, Nancy, he's not going on. So about a half hour goes by, and I realize this guy's not going on. So for a month, we went around, played every venue to rehearse, and he wouldn't go on to an empty. So I've played the empty house of every venue, huge venue in Europe.
So you never got to open.
I never went on. And then I flew back, and he went on the next day. And that was my, and then I was like, I'm done.
What do you mean you're done?
I quit singing.
What do you think that you go back and he goes on? Did you put those together, or?
You mean I was the cause?
No. I guess I would have thought that, like, you know, like I did. The way you said it, it was like.
Well, what happened was I flew back and they had to go to Germany. And they went to Germany and he went on in Germany. I don't know.
But there was some behind the scenes political thing that had nothing to do with you.
No, there was something going on.
That was why he wasn't performing.
The reason why they didn't tell me for that month was, I think it was an insurance thing where they'd get ready to go and they'd have to make like they were going to. I don't think he had any intention of going on. But I'm not sure if that's true or not, because I feel like Pearl would have said something.
So that got you. That's it. I'm out of the music business.
I came back. I got together a new band for a while. I was acting in commercials and making a lot of money weirdly through that. And then I went through like this deep thing where I was like, I wrote my first screenplay. And within, I would say, a month of writing that, I had somebody who wanted to pay. And this is another crazy story. But who wanted to pay for it, who was work? It was 9/11. It was right before 9/11. He was working at the World Trade Center. And he was like, I want to give you the money to direct this, my first show, who was an old friend of ours. And that was a movie that I asked John to. At that point, John was dating Evie. And Evie said, come see John in the show. And I was like, and I'd already cast all the parts, and I saw John, and I was like, this guy is genius. And I was like, oh, and she was like, come see improv. And I was like, ugh, improv, I hate that.
Why did you hate it? Because
it's like, I hate theater games. I hate,
and
like,
that's what you thought improv was.
Yes. And
well, essentially it was that. I mean,
I'd never heard of long form.
And you had only been experienced dramatic improv in college,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's right. I mean, we had done improv, but it wasn't for laughs, and it wasn't in front of a crowd.
And it was to workshop. If you were working on a play, I'm gonna improvise this character.
Yeah, like it would be like, we're doing the Three Sisters. Let's improvise the scene that happened before we walked in. And this guy was an amazing director who's now running Juilliard. Richard Feldman was the guy who originally did that kind of work.
So you go and you see John.
I see John. They do this thing where they. was it a ring a bell? I can't remember what it was, but like somebody said a word or something, and they did like 45 minutes on the dot, and they went through like 10 different characters each, and it was, it had pathos and it was funny, and by the end of it, they told a real story, and I was electrified. Like, I couldn't believe that this was happening. And I was like, I went up to him and I said, I don't really have a part, but I have this guy in a waiting room. Do you want to come in and do that? And he's like, sure. And he showed up and we had a blast. I was like, okay, why don't we do a scene where you're waiting and you're trying to psych out the lead actor who's also going into the waiting room.
Classic to get, and you know, she just
right. And then I said, and Lauren Katz was there as well, who was also in the show. And I said, Lauren, you are also trying to psych him out. You know, and so then they started to do it. And then I was like, I couldn't believe how funny it was. And it was supposed to be like 3 seconds of the show. So then 9/11 happened. The World Trade Center went down and my movie was on hold. Thank God the guy who gave me the money for it lived. But everybody had died. So I didn't want to work on
the movie. In the towers, they had died.
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't want to work on the movie. And I just kept editing and re-editing this scene of John's. And I called him and I said, you know, I would love to just explore working this way with you. Would you consider, I have a seed of an idea. Would you consider, you know, working on something? And I came over and John gives me all the props for it, but it's all him. It was me seeing what he was doing and just going, this is what I want to do.
And was that?
That was Memron.
Memron.
Yeah, that was Memron. And then Nancy shot, wrote, directed, produced, edited Memron for like $3. That thing won Slam Dance. And after that, we had kind of the cachet for us to do something else together.
So, and how'd you develop a partnership? Memron?
Well, we just loved doing Memron, and Memron was so great. And I had been looking for somebody to work with who could edit improv. I mean, I knew improv would be a great way to generate comedy. I knew it was a great space to get a style that you couldn't get anywhere else. And people had dabbled in it, but not much.
Talking about for the screen.
Yeah. Curb, you know, was kind of just starting.
Christopher Guest.
Curb wasn't even out yet. That's right.
Yeah.
The Office, which isn't even improvised.
The Office wasn't out.
But, you know, Spinal Tap.
Yes.
You know, that kind of stuff. And I had a deal at Fox to do something where I directed it. I did a terrible job. And I was looking for somebody who, and Nancy not only directed it as a player, but also could cut it in this way that was just awesome. It maintained the spirit of it, but at the same time kept a strong narrative going.
But it started, I mean, John gives me these props, but it started with me going to John and doing an interview. And I said, here's the idea I have. You know, the Enron Corporation, you work for a company. And I think John made up the word Memron. I don't even know. And I was like, and you have been fired and now, you know, you're out of work, but the job you had was totally fake. Like, because you know how those guys didn't really even have real jobs.
Right.
So I was like, just make up a title. And then John went on this riff, which was absolutely hilarious. And I just interviewed him. And then he got a big job and had to leave. So I kind of took that interview.
He got a big job, so he couldn't do the movie anymore?
He could, but he was like, you know, it was catch as catch can. So I took that opportunity I would like go, okay, John, who do you most want to work with? And then John, and then I would sort of make up a scene. It was so, I think we did like 2 major scenes and then I wrote out an outline for the whole show. And I remember when I said to John, he was like, this is insane. This is absolutely insane. But
well,
he
it was like a couple of
it.
Pages. It was very vague, but it was great. It turned out to be perfect.
But that's how you like to work, because you told me you don't like to offer you something with a script, a network TV show, a sitcom. That's not what you're interested in.
No, I can do it, but it's no. My inclination is to improvise. So if you give me a script and I'm doing a scripted piece and it's not working, or I feel it's not working, my natural kind of obsessive compulsive instinct is to start improvising. When I get nervous, I start making stuff up. So that doesn't bode well with people who really are in love with their words.
So your first show you guys created together was called 10 Items or Less.
Yes. That was a pitch we pitched to Sony and then sold to TBS.
On the heels of Memron.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it takes place in a grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fully improvised show.
Yep.
Why is it important, I mean, to do a fully improvised sitcom? Because I would think writing a sitcom would be easier and safer and in a better chance of it succeeding. Why do it that way? Why improvise?
I think that you're going to get comedy that is totally out of the box and not canned at all. And at the time, I think it's the whole reason why we were able to, like, we went from, like, essentially, I mean, I had directed this movie, but suddenly John and I are showrunners. And, you know, because nobody knew how I was working, I suddenly was directing all the episodes. We wrote all the episodes together. So there was this ability to jump over many hurdles that you usually have to wait years to get a break for. And I mean, I don't think we did that on purpose, but the reason why we did it was definitely for it's funnier. It's a lot funnier.
And there are production value too. It's cheaper. It's more efficient.
In what way is it cheaper and more efficient?
I think that we can generate an incredible amount of material that you can't do with scripted stuff. Scripted stuff, and there's also just an energy that gets created on a set with the crew, with the staff, with everybody, that you're in this, you're much more in this world of vital creation that you don't get when you're just trying to get a good take. And I think that I just feel strongly that that bleeds into the product.
And when you say you guys would write it together, would you just outline it and show, how would you work? So if we were in a scene, how would that work?
We would sort of, we knew, you know, first we had to figure out how many scenes we could shoot because we only had 2.5 days to shoot it. So we would essentially put up like boxes and go, okay, this is the first act, second act, third act. Then we would break the show out really roughly. And then we would write it. Each scene would look, it would look like a little short story. It'd be like 23 pages, really heavily scripted, but with no dialogue. So it would be like John walks into a room and sees that there's a can of Coke. He drinks it and notices something's on the Coke. You know, so it'd be things like that.
And then, but no dialogue. And so, and the scripts were never shown to the actors. The executives would see them.
Right.
The crew would see them. But the actors wouldn't see them.
And the joke was in there. I mean, our whole thing was like set up a funny scene, get 2 really amazing or 3 or 5 or 100 great actors in there, and it will take care of itself, you know.
And what about you? Networks are famous for giving people notes. They want a medal. There's always friction between the creative and the, you know, in the networks. How did you guys navigate around that?
Well, by accident, we developed a process that is unnotable. I mean, you can't, the executives would note the scripts and we'd be like, okay, you know, and we'd take the notes or battle the notes at times.
But every once in a while, we'd take a note and later go, oh my God, this unraveled the entire show. Because, you know, they'd be like, so-and-so shouldn't say this. And then we kind of didn't really think it through and go, okay, well, we'll say have him say something else. And then we realized later, like, oh, they were trying to avoid that. Like, we did a show about Jesus Christ appears on a wall. And as a stain, and the whole impetus was like he takes that and tries to use it to sell products. And they were like, okay, but he shouldn't sell products. And we were like, okay, thinking it's just going to be a little rewrite. But and then on the floor, we were like, oh, wow, the comedy is really if he can't say that he's using it to sell products, we're screwed. So,
but a lot of times we would just take their notes knowing that the actors are never going to see the scripts.
Yeah.
So
and
we're like,
never
okay.
Say those lines.
Yeah, they say, well, can he say something like this? And we're like, yeah,
sure.
But you realize he's never going to see this piece of paper. But it made them feel happy. And then when they were on the floor while we're shooting, there's no way. It's not like there aren't takes. The takes are like 15 minutes long, and Nancy's throwing stuff into this. It's unlike any set you've been on.
Great, because now we're going to improvise. Because I am so fascinated about improvising for the screen, mm-hmm. because it's hard to do, and it's a specific talent, wouldn't you say?
Yes.
You know, and I've seen a lot of people think they can do it, mm-hmm. but it takes more. It's a skill.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's more. I think, you know, a lot of improvisers don't do well in this style.
Yeah.
Why is that? Why is that, Nancy?
I think that the really what you work on is backstory. And a lot of improvisers are trying to outthink the other person in a gamey way. And really what you need is reactors rather than generators. Or, you know, a lot in the beginning, we used to do a lot of like, okay, John is like a generator. John can like say, you know, he can say a million things like in a million different ways, one thing. And so every take is different. Most people, I would say 99% of the people that we hire are people who they have a funny thing and then they do it again and again and again, which is great. So you put a generator with somebody who can do a great one-liner, but isn't going to completely like rip up the fabric, you know?
All right. So tell us what you have for John and I today.
Okay. All right.
What so show are we
Does
doing?
Everybody know Quick Draw? Probably not.
I know it's a Western.
Okay. So let's imagine John is an investigator.
Okay.
And you are a priest.
Okay.
And
are we in the 1800s?
It's the 1800s. Okay. Although that's not going to matter.
Okay.
For you.
All right. Okay.
Don't let that bog you down.
Okay.
Because that's the first thing.
Okay. Did that bog you down when you guys were doing the show? When you get actors in, they'd be like, "Oh my God, it's a Western."
No.
Not okay. really. We would sometimes send them some stuff of some jargon and stuff from the 1800s, yeah. but...
They okay. loved the jargon.
Yeah, okay. They
loved it.
The network did or the actors?
The actors.
Okay.
All right. So let's say there was a murder at a brothel.
Okay.
And you were there.
Okay.
And you saw it. Mm-hmm. But you didn't want to tell anybody about it.
Okay.
Because you don't want them to know.
Right.
John, you at the same time... And this is a lot of what we'll do is like somebody will come in with cross purposes.
Right.
John, you've come in to talk to this new priest about, and you're in a confessional, and you've come to talk about your wife who you had some trouble with, as we know, and you're trying to get his advice to see if you're actually really married. You have no idea that he witnessed this murder. Every time that John says anything that might have to do with the brothel, you're sure he knows, and
okay.
he's trying to get you to confess.
Okay.
Okay?
So I'm trying to get John to confess?
No. He's trying to get you to confess. You're okay. just a priest.
And I'm just listening to confession.
And you witnessed a murder that okay. you don't want to tell anybody about because
okay.
you were in a brothel.
Oh, okay. So I have some shame because I'm a priest. I shouldn't be in
yeah.
a brothel.
And by the way, when we do this, a lot of it is it's so much backstory so that you get out of your head a little bit.
Okay.
So
now I'm also in my head right now mm-hmm. because I'm thinking John's the generator and I just need to react to
Don't
it.
Even think about that.
Okay. And also in my head, how long are you going to let this go, this scene?
How long do you want it to go?
I don't know, like a couple minutes or whatever?
Yeah, just put your hand up. Because I'm also going to be coaching you as you go. So when we're
shooting... Oh, this is great.
Yeah.
This is the part I love. I love the process,
yeah.
your specific process.
So generally when we're shooting, you're going to start doing the scene. And if it's a two-person scene, I've got everybody on camera. But a lot of times it's like 20 people. So a lot of times I'll have to say that again as I swing the camera in mm-hmm. their direction. But usually what I'll do is I'm waiting for the good stuff. And usually, you know, it'll be a 15-minute take, and I'm waiting for something good to happen. And when it does, I'll say, "Do that again."
Okay.
Do that again. And it what it means is I want to make sure I got everything, like coverage-wise.
So when you say "do that again," repeat the same lines?
No,
sometimes,
it just means like do that section again. Sometimes it'll be good.
Yeah. So you want us to go and make some discoveries in that section?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Great. This is. I'm scared and excited at the same time.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're
this
in the confessional.
This is the abyss. This is
the abyss.
Yeah. yeah. John, you've never been here.
Okay.
You've never met him.
Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. Hello?
Yes.
Oh,
I'm just
okay.
wondering if I know you.
Well, isn't the whole purpose of this that I should be anonymous?
Yes, you're
I
right.
mean, what
you're,
do you mean?
It's, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's anonymous.
Are you a father? You're a father, because I can't see you.
I'm a priest.
If anyone should be giving identification on this in this relationship, I feel like it would be you, because How do I know you're a priest?
Well, you're just going to have to take my word for that.
Okay, now you're going to go back and do the beginning again. And this time, you see him coming in. Mm-hmm. You know it's him.
Okay.
Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned.
Bart.
Oh. Well, why would you say that?
That's your name.
Yeah, I know, Father Henderson, but you don't bring it out.
Could you lower your voice? There's a couple people outside.
Are you doing two of these at the same time?
No.
Is somebody else on the other booth?
No, no one's in the other booth. It's just me and you.
All right.
I just, it's between us. I don't want people to know your sins.
Right. Good point. I just wish you hadn't pointed out that you knew who I was, because that now just I feel naked. I'm not naked, by the way.
Why did you bring up naked?
No, I mean, I felt naked.
Like a naked body?
No, like exposed. I felt like an exposed wound.
What are you saying?
I'm saying that once you said who I am, now that I know you know who I am, I feel like the veil of an anonymity. I can see, if I read it, I can say it. You know what I mean?
Okay, great. Now go back. And so what I'll do sometimes is sometimes the seed of the thing isn't working. Like I'll be like, we're not getting in there. Usually it's written a little better than that. But John, in this part, let's alter this just a little bit. So in this section, when you sit down, I think what you want to confess to him is this you're troubled over the murder.
Yeah.
Over
the murder.
Yes.
Okay. And then what do you want from me?
Same.
You
saw the murder. You don't want anybody to know about it.
Okay.
And you know that he's also on the trail.
Okay. Great.
Father, the reason I'm here is I don't know if you know this, but there was a terrible, terrible murder.
No, I don't know anything about that.
Okay.
Do you really want to bring that up right now? Don't you have other sins you'd like to discuss?
How do you know what I'm talking about? I didn't even finish telling you what I'm talking about. What do you think I'm talking about?
I think you're talking about your sins that you want to confess.
No, I was saying I'm here. I mean, I am here to confess sins, but more than that, I'd like to get some feedback about this horrid murder.
You know what? That is really not in my jurisdiction.
What are you talking about?
A murder, I mean, did it really happen?
What? And now, thinking about this, when you sit down and start to talk about the murder, maybe you think maybe you try to pin it on him.
Okay.
Are you saying that you did it?
Okay.
Okay.
Do you want us to start from the top?
Yeah,
okay,
just
great.
From that.
Great.
Father, forgive me. I have sinned.
Okay.
You know who this is, right?
Yes, it's Bart.
Yeah, right. I'm here because, I don't know if you know this, but there's been a horrible murder over...
And you're here to confess it.
What? No! As the murderer?
Yes. I would
Jesus!
Why don't you keep your voice down so other people don't hear that you're the murderer?
I'm the investigator!
Please.
Okay,
lower your voice.
All right. I'm the investigator. I didn't do anything. I'm trying to find out who did it. Okay?
This is the time to come clean, Bart.
I didn't do it! I'm here to try to find out who did it!
Okay, so...
Do you know
how many times did you stab the person?
What? How do you even know I'm talking about a stabbing?
Because most murders are done by
Wait a minute. What do you know about this stabbing at the whorehouse?
First of all, I don't know. It didn't happen at the whorehouse. I don't even know why you're bringing in the whorehouse.
What? Yeah, it absolutely did happen at the whorehouse. I just came from it. There was blood everywhere,
Is that where you went to hide the body?
What?
Yes.
No, I discovered the body when it was reported to me. How do you know there was a stabbing? I haven't told anybody anything.
I'm saying what you're saying. I'm just repeating back what you're saying.
I am so close to coming around to the other side and sitting right next to you.
You don't want to do two murders in the same day.
And there it is.
Okay. So what is it that you liked?
Okay. First of all, I liked everything.
Okay.
Isn't Jimmy great?
You're
fantastic. So great, Jimmy. You'd be
so
great in this process.
You would. You really would. So, when I first started out, I realized, this is really funny, but we're never going to get to the murder.
Okay.
Especially in television. Mm-hmm. You got to think about, how do we get to this in a timely manner? Now, of course, you're going to do it with editing, but sometimes you'll write something that doesn't exactly connect. you know, then sometimes I like, you know, as I did with this, is a lot of times I spend an inordinate amount of time on the opening. Because once we find the opening of the door, then it all comes out. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like sometimes you'll be like, oh, wait, maybe we should just try this again as a different opening.
It was very interesting for me to watch your process. Maybe I wasn't as present as I could have been, but you started to whittle it down.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know how Nancy works. You understand her shorthand. How long does it take improvisers/actors when you cast them to get this? Because a lot of times you're like, okay, the first one didn't work. The second one didn't work. Now there's like, oh my God, maybe I'm not doing something.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, we try to, it used to be, I think, a lot more panicky. Now a lot of these guys have worked with us in the past and they realize that it's not about what isn't working. Because I might have liked the second take.
Mm-hmm.
And I might have said, okay, the second time you did it is the one I want. But I might be trying to get like a one-liner from John, or I might be trying to get some other thing. So I always say to the person, listen, just because I tell you to, usually when I tell you to do something again, it means you're doing something good. It means it's given me an idea. Now, right now, even for example, with this, I probably would not have jumped in so many times. I would have let the scene play out one time fully through. But when I first started directing, I probably would have jumped in like that. But now I've sort of learned to kind of sit back, let the scene go. And then if it's really not working, I'll be like, hold it. Why don't we try that again with a different beginning?
I would think as producers in general, we've kind of learned to lean back a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and let people all in all departments do their job.
Yeah.
At least once or twice. As producers, we've really shifted from this kind of micromanage-y kind of like we got to get it right to, hey, we're going to create a place where Jimmy is going to do what he does best.
Right.
How can we put Jimmy in a position to do what he does best?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you create that?
Our sets are really supportive. Actors, I mean, maybe they're lying to us. I don't think they are.
I think they have a blast.
They feel,
I really do.
And crew, too. They feel emboldened. They feel, you know, loved, you know, and which sounds silly, but a lot of people are dicks on sets. And in comedy, that really sucks.
Why is that?
I don't know.
Why is that?
I don't know. We say that in every production meeting we have. We say, look, we have one rule. If you're a dick, we're going to fire you.
Yeah.
You know?
And we're not curing cancer.
Yeah.
Let's have some fun.
And we've had to fire a couple of people because they were jerks. And I remember one guy we fired, and we tell this story a lot. He was an electrician, and he said something. We got a report that he got in a little bitchy argument with a hair person and over a stinger, you know, over a extension cord. And we said, sorry, you're gone. And he, like, called back in tears. Nobody had ever said to him, you got to be cool on a set. And we're like, look, we're making a half-hour comedy here. Why are you tearing her a new asshole over an extension cord?
Why is it you think that, you know, we got into comedy for the fun of it, right? To have a good time. And then it's like all of a sudden, like, people are taking it really seriously and being really dicky about it sometimes, you know?
I think it's fear. Everybody's
yes.
scared.
I mean,
everybody's
look, you know,
scared.
In the beginning when we were doing our first show with 10 items, people would get, even actors, you know, like, it's a high-pressure situation. It's not like a sitcom where you're saying four lines over and over and over again. And so we would have to kind of go around to everybody and be like, you know, when you're just staring into space, these actors feel that this is a 15-minute take. And then we'd also have to go to the actors and go, guys, we only need like four lines from this. And if you can't do four funny lines, I'd be shocked, you know, like, so to let them know, you know, it's not so precious.
Yeah.
We're just having a good time for like 15 minutes. I'm going to get four good lines. Don't worry. Just take that off
your back. We're going to make product good enough to sell some shampoo.
Yeah.
Trust us.
I just love your process. I love how I mean, it's so clear. What is going on in your head? Are you thinking in the future, like, oh, I'm going to edit this?
Yes. Yeah.
Can you tell us what's in your head?
Well, when I first started shooting this, I was learning to edit at the same time. And what I really started to learn was, you know, how to get the right coverage Like, you know, we have a Bible of things that you can't do. Like, for example, you don't want to have someone enter or exit in the middle of the scene, because then you can't cut the scene any way you want.
The years, we've just found certain things where we're like, oh, God, we're never going to do that
again. Oh, this screws us, you know. And things that, you know, sometimes we'll break the rule, you know, but generally there's like a set of editor rules that we've set up because we've been screwed so many times. And so a lot of times what I'm thinking is like, for example, let's say John has some amazing monologue and I'm like, I know that this monologue is going to be, I just know, like, because I'm sitting there going, this is the monologue. I'm not always right, but generally I've gotten better at it. I'll be like, I'll have to think back, what did he say to spark that monologue and did we get it? And then, so a lot of times what I'll do is we'll do these long takes and then I'll go back and say, can you say that, a couple of times we're going to run through just the beginning of the monologue, just to get him into the monologue. So things like that, so I know that I'm not, because a couple of times we've had things where like some amazing monologue happened and the person who sparked the monologue was not on tape, or, you know what I mean? Like, you know, you're just like, you know, you have like 8 mics. Sometimes we had like 20 people talking. So it was a lot of like, oh my God, okay.
And she's rolling 3 cameras, sometimes 4.
Yeah. Like a math equation, too.
Mm-hmm. So, in what way?
Well, like my DP and I will sit and sort of go through the blocking in our heads of what, so that we can set up all the cameras correctly before everybody comes in, or we take forever.
They don't really know what's going to happen.
We shoot the rehearsal. So generally, you know, now it'll be fairly, you know, in the beginning it was very simple choreography. Like, be like, John, you're going to walk in and stand. You know, a lot of people are like, I need to do my own blocking. You can't with this. It was just too hard. So it'd be like, John, you're going to walk in and stand here, you know. Then as, you know, as Quick Draw came along, we were doing gunfights and things. And that is even more insane because, you know, you got to remember exactly where the shooting is happening, and then somebody says something funny and you got to remember, you know, it's just, and with, especially with gunfights or things where somebody's, you know, action sequences, in that case sometimes you can only shoot one side, so you really have to be like thinking about what's the other side.
So what John and I just did, what would have made it into the show?
Oh wow, it's hard to know because it's all about the overall plot. I probably would have had, I love that he knew who he was, who is this, it's Bart, you know. I probably would have gone more towards the second take, probably.
But you would, what we did, you would have gotten what you needed?
She wouldn't let us go until she had it.
Yeah.
But she would, generally, it seems like Nancy finds a joke. Mm-hmm. That she loves,
yeah.
And then builds the scene out
so
from that.
So what joke did you love in what we did?
Yeah.
What was the joke that you...
I wasn't thinking about it, mm-hmm. but I would probably say I would go towards the, like, as we shifted to him saying he knew, you know, about the murder, and I would sort of go into the whole, you know me, mm-hmm. I know you, how long are you in here? If I didn't have a plot to go mm-hmm. by, I would have spent a lot of time in the, you know, shut up. I like the shut up that
right.
somebody's outside and
right.
you have an appointment. You know what I mean? Like, I would have gone into a lot more of that behavioral stuff because
mm-hmm.
I like that stuff.
Now, before Quick Draw got picked up, you guys put together this daily blog.
Yes.
That I loved it, and you spoke candidly about the process of getting a TV show produced. How therapeutic was that for you?
Oh, we loved it.
Yeah. We're still doing it, by the way.
Yeah. We just restarted it.
And we had no idea. We did, basically what the vlog was is we would do a daily video that was anywhere from 3 to 10 minutes, I guess, on what we were up to that day in our careers.
Yeah.
And the whole conceit was we had determined that we were going to sell a TV show in 60 days, or die, or we'd kill ourselves.
Yeah, John would kill me and then himself.
Yeah.
Which became a big plot point within.
Yeah. And but we would take a hidden camera to every, you know, pitch meeting we had and all kinds of stuff. It was great.
Mm-hmm. Well, did agents ever say, hey, you can't say this, or hey, don't film us? Or
no, but we would go in and people like, I remember we went to a pitch show at TBS. They said, oh my God, are we going to be in this week? So
we had no idea how many people in the business were following it. Like, we'd run into executives and people all the time. And go, oh, my God, how's it going? Are you going to sell it?
And I loved it when you got really close. And you're like, I can't say anything. Our manager said we can't say anything. I love that. Like, you went up to the edge and say, you know.
Because we did sell it. This was a show we actually sold to NBC. Right?
Yeah, yeah, we did.
We wrote the pilot. It was called Retreat.
Okay.
We made the pilot, but then it
didn't get picked up.
Yeah, but it kept us alive because we did, in fact, sell it.
Right now, we just started our own website called www.howler.tv. And we are doing a new season where we're actually developing the show and showing outtakes of scenes on the website. It's a show about burlesque. But in this case, the fans get to, like, comment on the sizzle reel, and we're going to show them the pitch, and then we're going to go in and pitch it to our agents. And they're going
to. What kind of feedback have you gotten?
People love it. They're just like, they can't believe that somebody's taking them inside this world of, like, what goes on. How does a TV show get pitched?
And it's the opposite of what people are usually so like, we can't tell anybody our idea. We're telling everybody the idea.
And you don't feel like, oh, we're going to get ripped off?
We might, but, you know, it's hard to rip off an improvised show. You know what I mean? I mean, good luck. Yeah. If you can do it, good luck to you.
Yeah.
As a partnership, how do you guys complement each other?
Well, Nancy does most of the work.
That's so not true.
What do you mean by
no.
that?
No. Yeah, it's not true.
It's like, I mean, we spend every single day together.
All day
in a room.
In one room.
So it's very much like a marriage. It's more than a marriage. I spend more time with Nancy than I do with my wife. It's very intimate. We know everything about each other. We do everything. I mean, for a Quick Draw, for example, Nancy and I wrote every episode. We ran the show, the showrunners, from top to bottom, actually running the show. Our company was the studio and made all the deals with all the unions. I starred in the show. Nancy directed every episode. Nancy edited every episode. I was the post-production supervisor on the series.
But we had editing help.
Yeah, we have crew and stuff. But all I'm saying is that the two of us were in from inception. We were from the mouth to the anus.
Yes.
You know, making that, show out.
I'm the anus. Yeah.
How do you guys compliment each other?
You know, John, I feel like I can tell you what John's taught me over the years. Like, John has made me, like, when we first met, I was the type of person, we'd get in a fight and I'd be like, I'd walk out the door. I was like the guy in the situation. And John would be like, no, we're going to talk this through. Whatever, you know. And he's made me a better person, I would say.
I would say Nancy is very much better at me. I'm a people pleaser. She's very good at saying, no, I want it. This is what I want. You know, she's very good, which is what a director does.
Did you get that from therapy? Because I struggle with asking for what I want. Did therapy help you with that?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. And... you know, I'm just a stubborn Taurus. That's just me.
But it works, the two of us. And we talk about this all the time because both of us help each other. You know, she's very good at saying, no, we need this. And I'm very good at saying, yeah, but let's keep our options open. And so together, it's a really good fit, you know?
And how do you settle creative differences? You guys have the glass of water rule.
you want to tell us
about that?
Well, if, you know, in any conversation, you trigger the other person. Sometimes completely, you don't even
just
know
like,
you did it.
Just like in marriage with my wife, you don't, they're bringing their stuff and you're bringing.
And after a couple of, like, big heated arguments, we don't have them often, but when we do, they're quite big.
I mean, you're like yelling at each other.
We're flooded.
And then we talked. The first time when it first started happening, we started to realize there was a pattern, and I'm not kidding, where we hadn't eaten. And we'd be like, it always happens when we're hungry.
Low blood sugar.
Yeah. Then we started to realize we need to say something to say to the other person, nothing on you, but I'm triggered and I hate you right now. Like, that's how major this is.
So give me an example of what would trigger you.
A classic is when we're breaking a plot and one person thinks this needs to happen and the other person thinks this needs to happen.
Yeah.
And they're diametrically opposed.
Right.
And we usually find compromise and both positions make the third choice stronger. Mm-hmm. Every now and then it's just like, I think this. And both people really do think that.
Right.
And so it's very difficult because you don't want the you don't want to fold because you're both coming from the place of like, I want to make the show better. Mm-hmm. But then it just gets further and further entrenched. And at some point, you know, it becomes personal or it feels like it's personal or you feel so frustrated and your cortisol level in your brain just like triggers. Yeah. And you're just like, you can't listen to reason and they can't listen to reason and you're stuck.
Yeah.
And that's when we do the glass of water trick.
And then what happens?
And then one or the other of us will get up, say, I need a glass of water. And it's used to be, we had a word.
Elephant.
And the word was not working.
Yeah.
Because
right. We felt stupid.
Word.
And you're so mad at
you're
the other
so
person.
You're so mad you don't want to say the word elephant.
Right.
You know what
it
I mean?
Feels like a retreat,
yeah,
too.
And it seems right. Sort of bitchy, too. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah, elephant.
Right.
So then you'd be like, I need a glass of water. And then you go and you'd grab a glass of water and you have to drink the entire glass before anybody says a word. And, but
roughly how many ounces are we talking about?
A big
16,
glass. Sometimes
maybe,
I've gone
24.
Through three glasses of water before speaking.
Okay.
And it's amazing. It works.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, you know, with marriages too, you just take some time.
Yeah.
You know, and you go, oh, God, I didn't even really care that much about it, to be honest with you. I
and
was more
just,
upset with the way you
yeah,
said it this way to
you
me.
You have to find your empathy again and just go, don't attack. Don't attack.
Yeah.
Retreat.
It's hard.
It's very hard.
Yeah.
And have you guys ever, like, done couples therapy? Because I've heard...
No.
We never have. There's this organization called PET, Parents Effectiveness Training, that my wife and I did. And they do one for business partners. And I mentioned it to Nancy a long time ago.
Yeah.
And we have the email saved, but we've never done it.
You know, the other thing I think about is, like, what does, like, a male-female writing team bring that, say, a female-female writing team or a male-male writing team can't bring?
Well, women aren't funny, so
yeah.
I have to be there
just to make it
funny,
yeah,
as we
hit
well
it out
know.
Of the park every time.
Yeah. No, I don't know.
I don't know.
The male-female thing hasn't... I don't know.
As a woman, I can say sometimes it really helps in a room just to have... You know, a male press, you know, it's like, it's great because you kind of are covering all the bases.
Well, Nancy, you know? It's amazing because Nancy is the director of our stuff. And it's amazing to see the misogyny in the business.
Yeah.
You know, we'll
like,
have.
Like, how does it show up subtly? Because it's got to, right?
Most of the time, they'll just make eye contact with me.
Yeah.
And I'll even start trying to move my body
yeah.
to look at Nancy to get them to look
and John
to Nancy.
And John is amazing at being like, well, that's a question for Nancy.
Yeah.
And he's really great at, but I would say it happens more often than not.
Oh, yeah. It is. As a man being with a woman partner, I've seen it and it is there. It's very clear and it's horrible.
John is very sensitive and very compassionate.
Amazing.
Was that after you got sober?
No, I think alcoholics and drug addicts in general are very sensitive people and they tend to medicate themselves because they don't want to be sensitive.
I would agree with you.
Yeah.
And I grew up, I was always a sensitive kid and I was told, don't be sensitive. And
yeah.
you know, I wasn't allowed to express my emotions,
yeah.
which was awful. And it led to many, many addictions.
See, this is what I love about his podcast. He always gets to this place.
Yeah.
Which is what?
The therapy, the humanity behind what improv really is, which, by the way, is what I think makes improv so great. Like, you know, we did three takes. The first take, you're a little nervous. We're trying to do this
totally
thing.
Totally nervous.
The second take, you know, you're feeling, you know, but if we did real full takes, what starts to come out is not what you are preparing or trying to do. What comes out is the truth.
For
you know?
Good and bad.
Yeah. And that's the stuff we live for.
I mean, been some things that people have said where you're like, oh, no.
Like what?
Yeah.
I remember there was a character, I won't say on what, but he basically called this woman a name. And you could tell he meant it.
Because she was the antagonist in the narrative.
Yeah.
Okay. But in his brain is using that excuse to criticize the actual actress.
Yeah.
And you see what I'm saying?
And yes. She could sense it. And she had a full meltdown.
Yeah.
And we kind of never bounced back after
that. How, as a director, how did you handle that?
Well, both of us took her aside and said, listen, that was nasty. And you got to know that he's talking about your character. And he really was, but he was young. And there was just a little teensy bit of, like, joy in it.
Yeah.
It was like finding someone's...
button and pressing it.
Yeah, it would be like, oh, Nancy thinks she's getting old, so I'm going to call her an old person.
Right.
You know, like, so it was kind of along those lines. And it was like, look, you have to know that he's a young improviser and he's just trying to think of anything he can say to hurt your character. And she was not in a great place in her life. So she, you know, it was a kind of cascade of things. I don't think we did very well in talking her out of it, but I don't know that.
I think we did. I mean, look, we all, what can you do?
Yeah.
You just, it's human beings, you know, and that's what improv is. You know, people reveal, it's a therapeutic tool.
It is, mm-hmm. Yes.
And so your true self comes out in a way. That's what makes improv, to me, so exciting, is because you're going to a place that is raw and real. And I know actors have a process, straight actors have a process that gets there as well. I haven't been trained enough to know how or why they do that. But in improv, man, you get it right away, which is what I love. Mm-hmm. Because I could tell what a total jerk you are from that scene. Just yeah. Now, I know that because we've known each other a long
right,
time.
Right, sure. We've got to wrap this up. This has just been so much fun. And we always end the podcast with the same question. What would you give an improviser? What piece of advice would you give an improviser starting out today?
Listen and stay in reality.
And what do you mean by stay in reality?
Don't make up things that you think are funny. Just stay in the just essential of what the scene is about. You know what I mean? Like, I think people are immediately like, oh, I'm standing on an anus and we're looking into the, and you're just like, no, you don't need the accoutrement. You just need to, like, you know, listen to the other person and feed off of them rather than you trying to throw shit at them.
But what would you tell people to say? Well, so I got to be funny.
You don't. The situation should be funny. And that will take care of itself.
John?
Very similar. Don't try so hard. Don't try. Mm-hmm. Don't try. And just embrace the abyss.
John Lear and Nancy Hauer, thank you so much for being my guest here in Los Angeles on this episode.
Welcome to LA, Jimmy.
This was awesome.
Yes.
And there you have it, another episode of Improv Nerd is in the Can. I want to thank our guests, John Lair and Nancy Hauer. And I'm going to plug it right now because they have a wonderful website with Quick Draw on there and 10 Items and Less and some other original content that they're creating. It's a very fun website. Go to holler.tv, that's HOWLER.TV, and check it out. It's worth checking out. I'd also like to thank Dustin Marshall at BarrelAudio.com for producing this episode on the LA side, and then back putting it together here in Chicago is Dan Schiffmacher, who makes me sound so slick and so professional. You wouldn't be hearing my voice if it wasn't for Dan. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv workshops and classes, The Art of Slow Comedy, and my books and my improv blog, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. Also, follow us on Twitter at improv_nerd. Like us on Facebook at Improv Nerd, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. And check out our YouTube channel, which is Improv Nerd Podcast, all one word. I want to thank our sponsors today, the Out of Bounds Comedy Festival in Austin, Texas. For more information, go to outofboundscomedy.com. And also the Baltimore Improv Festival. For more information, go to baltimoreimprovfestival.org. And of course, I want to thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL. The 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome, not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced ve a pe in Spanish,
oh my God.
He spots his dear friend, who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh, my God.